finishing her rotations in veterinary clinical medicine. In 2010-11, she participated in the NIH support for international clinical research scholars program and was also based in Peru and Lima. And Karen is interested in infectious disease, environmental, and population health. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone. So, I would also like to share that I don't have any financial relationships to disclose. So first I'm going to give you a little bit of a background on Chagas disease. Both the protozoal parasite that causes the disease as well as the insect vector that helps to transmit the disease. And then I'll go into a little bit of detail about my study. So Chagas disease is caused by a protozoal parasite called Trypanosoma cruzi. And it was first discovered by a Brazilian physician in 1909, Carlos Chagas. This parasite can infect humans as well as other mammal species, and infection has been documented in over 150 different species. The duration of the infection is lifelong, and while most cases of Chagas disease are from Central and South America, the T. cruzi parasite is actually found all throughout the Americas, with its most northern range as far north as Pennsylvania and California. It's estimated that 10 million people are infected annually and that there are 10,000 deaths annually due to this parasite. The primary route of T. cruzi transmission is through a triadamine or insect vector. This vector feeds on the blood of humans and animals, and the T. cruzi parasite is found in the feces of this insect. So it's hypothesized that after the insect bites at the skin of its human or animal host, the human or animal will scratch at the bug bite and actually help the T. cruzi parasite gain access through the skin. However, you can have T. cruzi transmission without the vector, and that can be through blood transfusion, organ transplantation, congenital transmission, or direct ingestion of the parasite. So this diagram illustrates the different life stages of the T. cruzi parasite, both through the inside the triadamine vector and then also through the human or animal host. And the thing that I want to emphasize in this is that the epimastigote form of the T. cruzi parasite lives exclusively in the triadamine vector, whereas the trypomastigote form of the parasite lives both in the vector as well as in the host, the human or animal host. So Chagas disease actually takes on two forms, an acute phase of the disease or a chronic phase of the disease. The acute phase is seen 1 to 2 weeks, up to 2 months post-infection, and it's characterized by parasitemia, so the parasites are living in the bloodstream during that time. It can be asymptomatic, or the signs can be pretty nondescript, so fever, headache, malaise, enlarged lymph nodes. The chronic phase of the disease is actually the more common manifestation, and during this time the parasites are found in muscle or nervous tissue. About 20 to 30% of people chronically infected do develop signs and symptoms, and they are most commonly heart disease and digestive problems. However, neurological disease as well as sudden death have been reported with chronic Chagas disease. So diagnosis during the acute phase can be made based on visualization of the parasites on blood smear or through molecular techniques like PCR. However, diagnosis during the chronic phase of the disease is much more difficult, and currently there's no gold standard for diagnosing chronic Chagas. There are a series of serological tests that are available. However, their sensitivity and specificity vary depending on geographic location as well as the strain of the T. cruzi parasite. So the current standard of practice in human medicine is to do 3 different serological tests, and then if you get a 2 out of 3 positive, then you get the diagnosis as being chronically infected. So there are over 130 different species of the triadamine insect vector, and only some of these species are capable of carrying the T. cruzi parasite. And these various triadamine species actually have pretty different behaviors, and these behaviors can influence the parasite, the T. cruzi parasite disease transmission. So for instance, if the triadamine vectors primarily live in a domestic environment versus if the triadamine vectors primarily live in forested or sylvatic environments, that can classify the T. cruzi transmission cycle to be a domestic transition cycle, a peridomestic transmission cycle, or a sylvatic transmission cycle. Now, there have been several different multinational control programs established to try to halt T. cruzi transmission, as well as to control the triadamine vector. So the area where we were conducting our research in northern Peru is a part of the Andean Initiative. And the Andean Initiative has chosen to focus its control efforts on these four species of triadamines. And the primary method of controlling the triadamines is by house-based insecticide programs to halt the domestic cycle of T. cruzi transmission. So Chagas disease is a disease that disproportionately affects people living in poor communities. In Peru, it's believed that 0.7% of the population is infected, or 192,000 people. And it's believed that about 12% of the population is still at risk of infection. Most of what we know about Chagas disease is actually from southern Peru in the department of Arequipa. And in this region, the primary vector of the disease, the triadamine, is a species called Triatoma infestans. And it's believed that 5.3% of the human population in this region of Peru is seropositive for T. cruzi. So much less is known about Chagas disease in northern Peru. There have been reports that T. cruzi transmission is occurring in this region of the country. There are suggestions that there may be various triadamine vectors involved in the T. cruzi transmission. And while there are a couple of reports that document human seroprevalence, the actual magnitude of the T. cruzi infection in this region is very understudied. So our study was a cross-sectional, population-based study where we did a serological and entomological survey in four communities in the high jungle of northern Peru. We systematically searched for the triadamine vector inside of houses and just outside of houses. And we collected serum from humans and dogs from these four communities, Campo Florido, Casablanca, La Esperanza, and Pindoc. And additionally, we collected serum from guinea pigs from the community of Campo Florido. And guinea pigs were only sampled from this one community due to the labor-intensive nature of drawing blood from guinea pigs. So the communities where we were working were rural and small communities at about an altitude of 850 to 1,700 meters. The region has a tropical climate, and dogs and guinea pigs are common mammals that live within people's houses in this region. The community members were generally poor subsistence farmers. Houses were primarily made of wood and adobe mud bricks, and roofs were either made of corrugated metal or thatched plant material. So the objectives of our study were to determine the primary species of triadamine vector responsible for transmission of T. cruzi in these four communities in northern Peru, to determine the prevalence of T. cruzi infection in triadamines, dogs, guinea pigs, and people, and to determine the role that dogs and guinea pigs play in the domestic transmission cycle of T. cruzi. So in our study, we defined a case to be positive as follows. So for the insect vector, for the triadamine, they were determined to be positive based on microscopic analysis of their feces. Humans were determined to be positive based on having three serological tests and having a 2 out of 3 positive. And animals were determined to be positive by an epimastigote antigen ELISA. And we followed that up by doing a trypomastigote antigen Western blot as a reference assay to determine a percent agreement. And if you can remember back to the life cycle diagram that I presented earlier, the epimastigote form of the parasite is only in the triadamine, whereas the trypomastigote form of the parasite is both in the triadamine as well as the human or animal host. So while the trypomastigote antigen Western blot is not considered a gold standard, it has been used as a reference assay since it's this form of the parasite that the host's immune system encounters. So we found that between these two tests, guinea pigs had a 96.77% agreement, and dogs had 93.33% agreement, which were both highly concordant, which gave us confidence that the epimastigote ELISA was a good approximation for T. cruzi infection in dogs and guinea pigs. So our first objective was to determine which triadamine vector was at play here in these communities. So in these four communities, 208 houses were searched. About 40% of the houses had triadamines. A total of 2,140 triadamines were collected. And all of these bugs were identified to the species level, and they were one species, Panspermatus herrari. And then about 84% of these were further evaluated for the presence of T. cruzi in their feces. So there have been reports of this species of triadamine, Panspermatus herrari, as a domestic vector in this region of northern Peru. And the same species has been identified in Brazil. And it's actually interesting because in Brazil, the species Panspermatus herrari is actually a sylvatic species. So it lives mostly in forested sylvatic areas. But it's also known to be very versatile and have the ability to transition from sylvatic ecosystems into more domestic ecosystems. And as you can see by this map here, the region where we were doing our work is in this shaded area, and Rhodnius ecuadorensis, which is another species of triadamine, is the candidate species for interventions in this region in northern Peru. And currently, the Andean Initiative does not list Panspermatus herrari as a major vector for control efforts. So our second objective was to determine the prevalence of T. cruzi. And we found that in triadamines, 17.7% were positive. Dogs showed 20.4% positive. 3.4% of guinea pigs were positive. And 15.7% of humans were positive. So in comparing our data with other studies, we found that our canine seroprevalence was just about in the middle of what's been previously documented. And these documents have been all over Central and South America, which have reported between 1.2 and 67.6% seroprevalence in dogs. Our guinea pig seroprevalence was pretty low at 3.4%, and also is pretty close to what has been documented in Peru. And our human seroprevalence that we found was actually much higher than what has been previously reported from this region in Peru. The highest that's been reported in this area is 4.8%, and we found 15.7%. So our third objective was to examine the role that dogs and guinea pigs play in domestic T. cruzi transmission. So we did not find any increased risk for people who owned dogs or guinea pigs for having the T. cruzi infection. Nor did we find any statistical increased risk that dogs or guinea pigs served for increasing the risk of having triadamines in your house. However, we did see a sort of trending in our data that dogs looked as though they were trending towards having an association with if you had dogs not having triadamines, and guinea pigs opposite. So our data, again, it was just trending that having guinea pigs seemed to be associated with having triadamines in your house. Our working hypothesis is that dogs are potentially aiding in the control efforts of keeping triadamines out of people's houses. But again, that's just our working hypothesis. So other studies looking at the role that dogs play in T. cruzi transmission in Central and South America have shown that dogs can serve as a risk factor for T. cruzi infection for people who own them, and that dogs can also serve as a source for reinfestation of the T. cruzi parasite post-insecticide spraying within houses. Also, guinea pigs have been shown to be 2.3 times more likely to harbor triadamines than any other animal enclosure, and this is similar to what our data was suggesting. So what are the next steps for Chagas disease research in northern Peru? As I mentioned earlier, the species of triadamine that we found has been documented to be a non-domestic species of triadamine as well. And it's currently unclear if there are sylvatic populations of either this species or other species of triadamine in this area. And since the current strategies for triadamine control involve insecticide spraying within houses, knowing whether there's a sylvatic or peridomestic transmission cycle at play is very important because it could serve as a source for reinfestation post-control effort. So I'd like to thank the other contributors for this project and also the communities that participated in the study. And thank you for your attention. We were looking at 108 dogs.
108. Mm-hmm. I mean, because, you know, the relative risk zero of 1.9, it's almost 2. Mm-hmm. I would not be silicon proof that the presence of dogs is not a risk factor. Even though the p-value is certainly greater than 0.05, but the p-value is not a measure, really, of the association. It could simply just be an artifact of sample size. So, you know, I don't think you need to discount what your initial thought processes were. I mean, it would be good to see what the confidence interval says to see if it's more consistent with being a risk factor as opposed to being a protective factor. And I suspect it must be if it's 1.96.
Mm-hmm.
The other comment that came to me, though, as you cited the prevalences that were there, I don't know if... Did you adjust for what we call true and apparent prevalence? Because there's a mean that if you include the sensitivities and specificities of the test,
mm-hmm.
then you can get what we call the true prevalence, which generally actually is higher.
Okay. Interesting.
Than what it appears.
Yeah. No, we did not adjust for that, but that's definitely something that's interesting to look into. Thank you.
So I think it's probably worse than you think.
Okay. There's more to
that. Okay, you got to pick on your friend.
I have a question for you. I think it's really interesting that you found, you know, just in the data that you have, that you found the dog bites may be associated with less number of bugs in houses. And I was wondering if you or anyone has looked at the number, like looking at the presence of dogs in households and the number of bugs that are actually taken out of each house, or if, like, bug infestation in houses.
You know, we're still in the process of analyzing this data, so that's definitely something that we should make sure to look into. But
I don't know how you quantify bug population.
Well, we have for each house the number of bugs that were collected from that house, so we'll definitely look into that. Thank you.
So, questions for Karen or any other speaker? Yes, we'll go into South Carolina question.
I have a question for Stephen.
Yes.
When you looked at your oxybenzone coding, that's what you used as your diagnostic.
Right.
Variable. And as far as your limitations go, did you consider the possibility that conditions were coded for maximum reimbursement?
There aren't any differential coding reimbursement. There's no differential reimbursement at diagnosis.
Okay. The reason I ask that is because I know that with the babiosis, you had said that no cases had been reported to the Tennessee Department of Health.
At the time, and now there's, once we completed the study, there was a group that actually presented last year in Atlanta to claim they found the first medically diagnosed case through medical chart review, and it was found in 09. So it has now been shown. We found it about 6 years before we
did. Okay. Because I know in South Carolina, certainly we get, that's what I did with South Carolina epidemiologists to get disease reports. We do get things that are overlooked that doctors just don't report, but we also get laboratory, most of our reports are laboratory, are reported by the laboratory. So we'll get indicators for Lyme disease, ehrlichiosis, or RMFF, and they'll be reported to us as a diagnosis or an indicator, but they won't meet the CDC case definition.
Sure.
So when it goes into our system, it just doesn't count as a case.
Right.
So it's not that it's not reported, we just don't call it a case. So, for instance, Lyme disease is an endemic in South Carolina. We we have the vector for it, we just don't have many cases of it. So we might have 200 cases reported to us, and the diagnostic code on those 200 cases might be Lyme disease.
Right.
But we won't actually think they're cases based on the CDC case definition. So I just wondered if that might be something that you want to consider in your presentation.
Yeah, it's certainly a limitation. And that's why we introduced it as a data supplement and
okay.
a way to prioritize your efforts when you're trying to seek your outreach and your outreach.
Thanks.
Tom? Yeah, from Marina. I'm just wondering, did you break it down to ethnicity as well as immigration rather than just the socioeconomic standing? Because I'm thinking that different populations have different educations, and I was wondering if there was any linkages with the school educational program.
Yeah, we don't have that level of data in the database. And actually, we don't collect socioeconomic status data, so that's why we use census track information. But that would be a really good point because definitely ethnicities have different relationships to the animals. Thank you.
Going back to Stephen's point about the Babesia, this is anecdotal, but when I was doing preparedness, I'm also a subject matter expert for biowarfare agents. My background is infectious diseases, and I got a call from a CD nurse. Says, I don't know what to do with this. And she mangled Babesia. And I said, you're trying to say Babesia microti. She said, yeah. And I said, is this a reportable? And it says, it's not in North Carolina. Let me guess, she was up in Massachusetts. I said, yes, she was. And he says, it's not reportable here, but it's reportable in Massachusetts. So you need to refer back up there. So coming back to your point, is were those actually acquired cases in there? And that's one of the limitations to here is it doesn't tell you where they got the exposure. And the other is for the brief time I was in private practice in Jackson, that tick fever was the common term for this, and the primary did absolutely nothing to accurately diagnose this, which drove me up the wall. And reporting and underreporting was a serious issue.
Yeah.
So that's just a comment from.
Yeah, no good.
And they had a contempt for 10 care.
Marina, I want to say just thanks for your presentation. I mean, for me, whenever I hear a presentation on dog bites, it always warms my heart. It's hard to hear to even talk about that sort of a thing. I just have one question, though. Since the results clearly are based on reported dog bites,
yeah.
Is there any tendency, you believe, of animal care and control or physicians to report bites that might occur in areas where persons of lower socioeconomic circumstances live than in other areas?
Than in other areas? No, I think that it is more related to whether or not they know who reports the site as whether or not it's reportable by law. That would be a really interesting question to test, I think. Which I think is accessible looking at offset data and comparison to the reported data. But that is something I haven't considered.
We usually see that probably between 30% and 50% of all dog bites are reported.
Uh-huh.
Right? I mean, probably
well, even lower.
Yeah. You know, so if, I just wondered what is that, you know, what your thoughts might be of what it might mean in a day. I mean, I could imagine that, you know, whether a dog bite gets reported or not might depend on the severity of the bite.
Right. Well, that's why I looked at hospitalizations for in the reported dog bite database versus OSHPD, and there was still that underreporting where you would think that if there was a hospitalization that it would then be reported, but that's just not the case. So, I believe the total was 44, and then there was about 70. I don't quite recall the number of offsets, but it was much higher.
watch the business meeting?
Yes.
Okay, well, let me do that. There's a business meeting for the Veterinary Public Health Special Primary Interest Group at 6:30 in the Cabin John Room. And the One Health Academy, which exists here in D.C., is hosting a dinner tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at the Capitol Yacht Club. Let me give you the reference to that.
Okay, Tom, I guess you got one last throw at it.
My last question, relative to the dog bites, was there a history tracking of any of the dogs that have previously been vaccinated for the time frame of the last vaccination?
And it's also fun to think that we have veterinary students from Tufts, Cornell, and Colorado here today here in Washington, D.C. So thank you all for your presentations. Thank you all for attending. Tomorrow we have two more sessions, and Bill will be moderating those. And I appreciate all the questions.